great pleasure to introduce our Shiptasani fellow for the term, Professor Prabhavati Reddy, who teaches at George Madison University in Virginia in the United States, and is the author of this wonderful book, Hindu Pilgrimage, Shifting Patterns of Worldview of Sri Shailam in South India, which was just very recent, in that,
2014. Yeah.
2 years ago it was published. Today she will be talking to us about the ritual culture and materiality of sacred images in the Vaishnava temple tradition. So without further ado, I don't want to take too much time away from your lecture.
Thanks for your introduction. So a version of this lecture was presented at the conference on Indian religions in Chicago in 2006. So there is a lot of changes I made. This is going to be part of my second or third book, actually, on Vaishnava temple religion and images. And there are, I'm going to discuss more different issues in that book. So this is one of the chapter, or maybe two chapters. These are very broad topics, and I'm going to touch upon two aspects of, two major dimensions. What I'm going to do is the format. I will read a little bit, combining three or four ways, and read sometimes, and also go back to the, images, because images are important in between, and also sometimes I, explain, so kind of a combined format I use here. I will read just the first introduction of the abstract, so that you get, and then I go into the two dimensions that I am going to explore today. From temple building to image making, from temple rituals to domestic vratas, from village festivals to pilgrimage journeys, the Hindu temple religion demonstrates an integrated process of creating material forms and objects that express religious and cultural ideas. The material connections of Hindu temple religion are evident in the daily worship to images, they're called murtis in the sanctums, and in public festival performances that honor Utsava icons. Utsava icons are festival icons used for festival processions. My lecture focuses neither on the image making nor the performance of rituals in Hindu temples. Instead, it explores the material dimensions of sacred images as reflected in the ritual lives of deities and material objects used in festival exhibitions at the famous Venkateshwara temple that is located in Tirumala Tirupati. I will be showing a slide a little later. And the temple institution that oversees the management of the religious calendar of events and the ritual performances of Sri Venkateshwara. So here is even the sacred images, we do not think this way, but this is a new research area developing in the material culture, that not only things or the images, not just objects, they do have their own lives. They have a long history. Always we look at like objects, but they have their own lives. That is what we are going to see, one aspect. Those are the two dimensions. One is the ways the material objects are used on the bodies of sacred images, and the ways the relationships are created between the images and objects symbolizing religious and cultural values. I might touch a little bit also, in this whole process, the images also undergo some transformation during the festival processions. I will talk about that a little bit, maybe that's a huge topic there. But. And the second dimension is, this is a TTD, short form for Tirumala Tirupati Devasthanam. It's an organization, a massive organization that oversees not only this particular temple, this famous temple, but also 12 other temples. So I'm going to talk about, again briefly, TTD's involvement in the production and creation of relationships between the images and the material objects. I mean, the relationships are not happening by themselves. There is an agency. So this is the TTD is an agency. An agency that plays in doing all these things, and between, so creating relationships between images and material objects, as well as TTD also uses some strategies in the promotion of a mass devotional culture. This is a famous, very, very famous pilgrimage center, India and beyond India, you know, and a very wealthiest Hindu temple, maybe I can say wealthiest in the Hindu temple institution in India, okay. And so how the TTD plays, what role it plays, and also how it uses, what strategies it uses in the promotion of mass devotional culture, one, and the economic prosperity of the temple. So those are the two dimensions I'm going to explore. And so to begin with, that is the map locating Tirupati, where actually located in South India. You can see that Chennai, if you see the southeastern part, Chennai, Madras, the old, you know, colonial name. North of Chennai, you can see Tirupati is located in Andhra Pradesh state. From that is the state I came from. That is the Tirupati. And Tirupati is a district, basically, down the hills, you know. There are seven hills, actually. And so people always travel from North India or South, southern cities. They have to come to the Tirupati. And from there, they take a bus to the up hills. There are seven hills. And on the right is the temple camp complex. So you are already on the seventh hill, that is the Tirumala. And so Tirupati is major pilgrimage destination, and final destination is the Tirumala. So on the seventh hill, when people go, that is what the temple, the main temple complex. It is not a very huge complex comparing to other South Indian temple cities, but it is most unique, and in its own way, its popularity, because of the popularity. So that is the temple complex. You can see South Indian Gopura gateways leading to the sanctum, the golden covered plated sanctum. That is the what is called Ananda Nilaya. The dwelling of Ananda, the bliss. That is where the Venkateshwara, the statue of the Venkateshwara, is installed. I think before going to the images, I will give you one short introduction. Beyond the why this Vishnu, the Hindu god, taking manifestation on the hills, and you know, so this comes from the Purana, genre of Purana, Sanskrit literature. It's called Bhavishyottara Purana, and the story is told that there was a yajna taking place. You know, there was fire, you know, a huge yajna is taking place. All these sages and other people were, assembled. And the question was there, the question raised was, to whom, to which deity that sacrificial fruit should be offered? Who is that preeminent deity? You know, the question. So, in order to do that, this is a story, nice story. And in order to that, they selected among the attendants, they selected a sage named Bhrigu. And Bhrigu is supposed to go now test these three deities, you know, the Hindu triple deity, Trimurti, the Brahma, Shiva, and Vishnu. So Bhrigu is already a very short-tempered man, very arrogant, even though he is a sage. So he goes to this, you know, the heavenly places, and he, you know, he causes a trouble, and they don't ignore Shiva and Parvati, do not ignore at all him, and he gave a curse them, and he also goes to the Brahma's world, and Brahma also gave the curse, because they are also, I mean, intentionally they are, you know, they did that. So Bhrigu is angered by such, you know, thing, and he gave a curse, and he finally goes to the Vishnu's world. And Vishnu was taking like a happily, a Vishnu Maya, in a Maya, and or, you know, in the yoga, maybe sleeping. And he does not see the sages coming. These are the nice Purana stories, you know, passed on from generation to generation. And so the Bhrigu got angry, you know, obviously. He was not recognized and not only welcomed. So he gives a kick in the chest of the, on the chest of the Vishnu. You know, okay, sages do. And so now the Vishnu wakes up from that kick and notices, and he knows who kicked and who is coming. He knew all that. And then he says, Vishnu knows how to pamper, you know, the sages and mend the ways, you know, unlike Shiva, you know. So he says, "Oh, sorry, you kicked my chest. Maybe your feet is hurting," and he kind of massages the feet of the Bhrigu. Bhrigu is now happy and, you know, honored. And then, but Lakshmi, who is next to the Vishnu, was not at all happy. Because he kicked, Bhrigu kicked on the chest of the Vishnu. That is the place of the Lakshmi, goddess of wealth, his consort. Okay? She was insulted. And then she gives a curse to him. I am not going into those curses because it would take another lecture. And then she leaves the Vaikuntha, that is the heavenly realm of Vishnu. And Vishnu, poor Vishnu, stuck without Lakshmi, the goddess of wealth. Of course, he has to follow, right? So, this is the reason we are told that Lakshmi lives on her own and she goes somewhere, you know, there is a place identified in South India or Deccan region, and where she began her penance doing, you know, tapas, and the Vishnu leaves this. The whole reason was also, by then, the world was harassed by all kinds of, you know, due to demonic forces or whatever reason. So this is the reason. And then Vishnu follows and comes to this forest area and meet Vakula. And so it's a long story to make it short. And so this is the reason, is it is explained in the Bhavishya Purana, that Vishnu takes the manifestation of Venkateshwara, that is two words compounded. Venkata and Ishwara. Ishwara means Lord, and Lord of the Venkata hills. Venkata also means the one who removes the obstacles. So he is known to be. And this is the way he is known in the Telugu literature, because most of it is written Telugu and Tamil literature, and his stories and narrative traditions. So he is the deity of the Kali Yuga. And he came, and he has different titles, and I will talk about that later. So this is the brief story, and he comes, and he is, finally the temple was built, you know. I mean, it's like dated to 12th, 11th, earliest part of the temple, but, you know, extensions are done over a period. So maybe 15th century. We have hundreds of inscriptions, because it has been a famous temple since the 15th century. There are so many land grants were given by the kings, you know, throughout different historical periods. So that is the brief story of the why Vishnu is here. And now we are going to the images. So in this lecture, I am going to focus only two major images. One is Venkateshwara, that is the way the main statue, you know, installed or consecrated in the sanctum. You don't see him much, how he looks like, but I will read a little bit of description. Bare statue, how he looks, is a beautiful statue, but he is decked with all these ornaments, and so much is going on. And also that heavy, thick Tripunda mark, you don't even see his eyes, you know, etc. But that is the main statue. And the second icon that we are going to focus is Uchava Murthy. That is, Uchava means festival icon. He is a replica of Venkateshwara, but he is a kind of public figure, you know, entertaining figure. He is the one, his name is a long name, Malai Kuniya Nendra Perumal, Tamil mixed, you know, name. But now he is popularly known as a short form Malayappa Swami. Swami is the title, you know, always called God, sometimes Swami. So the Venkateshwara image, definitely historically we know that prior to the 966 CE, because there is an inscription from by Pallava king, queen actually, Pallava queen actually orders to create a replica of a small image of Venkateshwara, and she gives this donation. So we have a land grant inscription. So that means the original image was already existed by then. And for Malayappa, we have an inscription reference, maybe earlier than, but we know that he exists prior to by 1339 CE. So these are the two images we are going to focus on, and their relationships with the other material objects or natural materials, and the issues involved with those. So I will just briefly read about this Venkateshwara in the sanctum. This is a freestanding 8-foot black granite murti or image of Venkateshwara in the temple's sanctum, gives darshan to more than 20 million devotees every year. And during the annual Brahmotsava festivals, at least 50,000 pilgrims visit his shrine each day. Each day 50,000 on the, during the Brahmotsava. This is small, the hill, and the hill is completely, you know, crowded on that day. I was there, and you know, it was just amazing. The image of Venkateshwara is majestic and superbly executed, and its beauty shines forth from the intricate carvings that adorn it. Though most of this detail is lost beneath the ornaments and flower garlands that are regularly stacked high upon the body. On Fridays, Venkateshwara is given a ceremonial bath, and then he can be seen without ornaments or garlands and with a huge Vaishnava mark on his forehead. His face is serene. He looks straight, that you can't see there because of that wide patch, big patch of the Vaishnava mark. He looks straight means samadrushti at the viewer. So viewer is making a contact. That is the darshan, contact making with the viewer. And he has an extraordinary smile filled with the tranquility. That also you don't see much there. Even when I visit, because of this, so many people make pilgrimage, and when you can't even stay there after so many hours of waiting in the line, maybe days sometimes, you know. And when you enter the sanctum, the front room to the sanctum, and you hardly stay there like less than a minute. You can't even get, and people are pushing you, and so much, you know, going on, and you barely get a sense of him, you know, how he looks like. And so that is the thing with the Venkateshwara. He has a broad chest, strong shoulders, and his hands are modeled closer to the body. His right hand shows the boon-giving gesture, Varada. That is his Kali Yuga. That is what boon-giving, gift-giving, you know, he is famous for that. And left points to his waist. The left one is placed slightly on the waist. There is a technical term for it. I am not going into those details. His elongated crown is over 20 inches high. Vishnu is always, this is the one iconographic difference between Shiva, and Shiva has also, but Vishnu has it's a very long crown, you know, because he is seen as the king of the, you know, as a divine king, like a kingly way he's treated. So it is here, his crown is over 20 inches high and exquisitely carved. You don't see that even though, because you have there maybe a silver or a diamond studded crown over his head right now. The Malayappa, I will hold on to him, and I will introduce you Malayappa Swami little later. Now I am going to talk about this treasure, amazing treasure. It has accumulated from 13th century onward. Kings were giving donations, and queens were giving so much, you know, jewelry and all that. And now, in post 1960s, this temple became very popular, very famous, for different reasons, you know. And people give just like that, the money, the jewelry. It's amazing, you know. It's amazing. Venkateshwara has an extraordinary treasure house of material objects. I'm treating artifacts also as a material objects here, which can be broadly categorized into two types: sets of attire, body armor, jewelry, and ornaments worn by deities. And the second type is materials applied to the bodies of deities, either for ritual use or the beautification, aesthetic beautification or alankara of the images used in rituals. The attire consists of a vast collection of garments made of fine silk, brocade, and other precious materials. Venkateshwara's garments are unique. And who are designing? We should think about it. Who are designing, who is playing a major role in selection of the selective process, that we have to think. That is where the agency comes into picture. For example, a golden dhoti, dhoti is a traditional attire worn by the men, and here the deity wears a golden dhoti, is made of lace fashioned out of pure gold, and is the heaviest of all his attire, weighing about 40 kilograms. Think about it, 40 kilograms. That is the golden dhoti that you see extreme right. I mean, we should appreciate admire the craftsmanship of the goldsmiths and metalsmiths, though, you know. Now that is where when they give the Abhisheka bathing ritual on Fridays, that is what they put him in a cotton, garment over him, and they give with or they perform this bathing ritual with all different kinds of substances, and then after that he is decorated like this and he is ready for granting darshan. So that is where the people are allowed into the into the temple and to have darshan of Venkateshwara. So besides clothing, a great variety of jewelry consists of necklaces. I should also watch the time. I will stop at 3 o'clock, so half an hour for our questions. It's important that even though if I don't finish, I will stop at 3 o'clock. Projector problem.
I don't know why we've gone and plugged there.
I see.
Today's until 3.
Oh, 3?
Yeah.
You said 3:30.
No, 3:30 is the seminars.
Yeah, but it's in the... On the website, it says 3:30.
Yeah,
I don't know.
It's 3:30.
So 3?
Yeah.
Okay. I will skip more and more.
Some of us can stay after.
I will go to the, I will go through the, the images and the important... Okay, so this is the Anga for the body of the god. You can see the clean the air filter.
Yeah, it's clean.
Okay.
Can't get the message out.
Okay, so those are the. It's a long time and it's remaining there. Let me see. Okay, so that's a. All right. So the other set is you have seen the golden set, and this is a diamond jewelry. See, you can see how many varieties there. This is only a sample. Okay, we are talking about here the crowns, different kinds of crowns, and So this is and so these are the salagrama stones, naturally formed, an iconic form of Vishnu. Fossilized ammonite shells. They are naturally formed in this particular river called Gandaki River, that is at the foothills of Himalayas, where it is in Nepal. And so these particularly ammonite shells are produced in the banks of or at the banks of the river, and they are seen as an iconic form of Vishnu there. And I will just go to that Salagrama section. The uniqueness of the necklaces, this we are talking, one of the necklaces is called Salagrama, which is made of naturally formed ammonite facials, characterized by their discus marks. They are naturally formed with the discus marks, sometimes conch, so they are kind of identified with these attributes of Vishnu. And so they are naturally formed, they are not man-made objects. So in a way, they are also worshipped in the temples. This is an iconic form of Vishnu, and people sometimes when they go on a pilgrimage, they collect these stones from the river and take them back to their their hometowns, and they worship in their home shrines. So that is important. But here what is happening is, within the Vaishnava tradition, salagrams are perceived as natural emblems of Vishnu and believed to be invested with his divine presence. It's a phenomenology here, natural phenomena. As a part of that, the belief in that naturally manifested divinity of Vishnu. So anyway, but what they did is, they played a game here. The Salagrama necklace is made of stones, which are set in gold. They combined with the gold. They made it with the gold chain. And the gold beads are inscribed with the 1,000 names of Vishnu. So 1,000 names of Vishnu is the Sahasranama, which is Stotra, that is chanted in every day in the temples, so all over the Vishnu temples. And so here what is happening is, they combined, brought together an iconic form, and combined with this, Vishnu Sahasrara, 1,000 names of Vishnu. That names basically talks about his various manifestations in different times, or his power, you know. So that is, so what we are seeing here is the Vishnu's nature, Vishnu both in a transcendental form and as well as in immanent form. Immanent in this world is manifested, manifestation, immanent in this world, through the different ways, I mean avatars, incarnations, or the image incarnations. In the Vaishnava tradition, they believe that images are not just images, they are not just statues, they are the archavatara, the image manifestations, incarnations of God. So so that is what here, they brought together an iconic, and the that is the unique feature. And there is a list goes on, but briefly I say, there is a Lakshmihara, and that you can see on the left, and that is carved with 1,000 names of Vishnu. And this hara is, put on his body on special occasions. And that is also signifies why special occasions. And on the right you see, he has a waistband. Can you believe it? He has a waistband, and waistband has with all the plagues, and decorated with all the 10 incarnations, you know. So that is the, those are the, and I will, knowing now I have only 1 hour, including for questions, so I should. Unusually, not only he has a body, you know, the armor made of the, you know, all this, whether gold or, you know, some other metals, but he has also a sword he wears. You can see on him from the waistband, the Katari, Surya Katari, or the sun's sword. Again, this is again implies, goes back to Vishnu's earliest relationship with the sun. It comes short from the Vedic period and continues in the post-Vedic period. So still that identity is. But here in Vaishnava way, they approach it like, oh, in that when they chant in the morning, when they wake him up, what is called Suprabhata, through the chanting of the hymns, they say, oh, sun is there waiting on you and paying obeisance to you, and so it's a kind of something, sun is also serving you, and so in a way, on different levels, in of course Hinduism or Vaishnava tradition, there are so many levels of meanings and symbolism, and it goes on for, you know. So that is the, and now I move on to the material substances. So far we have dealt with the objects, artifacts we might call them, and now material substances. Here, on Fridays, this bathing ritual is given, but some particular, a set of natural materials are used. Civet oil, sandalwood paste, refined camphor, saffron, kasturi musk, flower garlands, tulasi leaves, and other things, you know. So they are used in daily worship. But in this particular picture, I am going to show you what is I am talking. Part of the Abhisheka bathing ceremony, what is called a special act called Punugu Kappu, is performed. The entire body of Venkateshwara is smeared with the civet oil, maybe massaging him, you know, relaxing him. See, this is the way how they treat. The image has the life force. That is what, when the image is established or consecrated, the life force, the prana, is established through the ritual and chanting. So until then, the image is like not in the museum. The, you know, any museum image is not ready to eligible for worship. It is not appropriate. According to agamic tradition, the life force is installed or, you know, enforced or, to, you know, something through the mantra chanting in mantra. So here, what is applied is, So the Thiruman cup is basically that white patch, you can see, very wide. People wonder always why so wide, big thick patches. And that is the one made of a refined camphor and used with, combined with the civet oil. And they place him the patches on his forehead. And the central, the red mark, that is called Sripada Renu. That is something in this whole ritual process. They put something, a paste, the paste of camphor paste. They put it at his feet, you know, while their bathing ceremony is taking place. And that's why it is called Sripada, the auspicious feet of this Venkateshwara. And so that is the camphor is given to the priests, attending priests, or some devotees, and very seen as auspicious, you know. So as you can see, the natural, even though they are saffron is saffron, when you use in biryani, that is a different thing. And but when you use saffron in this context for the sacred mark, for sacred image, it's different context. So the profane and the sacred here, how the secular context and the sacred context, you know, materials also can be transformed, you know, through according to the context in which they are used. So that is the those are the two, the material substances. And now we are done with the main image. Now we are moving with Malayappa Swami and his consorts. He has two consorts, Sri and Bhu, and he is the replica of Venkateshwara. The difference between Venkateshwara image and this one is, he is a Utsava icon. He can go out on a procession and a parade, and he can show and he can perform himself, you know. And Venkateshwara is a main image, that is Dhruvabhera, that is permanently installed and permanently stays there. So that is the difference between that one and this one, Utsava. Actually, Utsava icon enjoys, you know, great pomper and pampered greatly, and, you know, and welcomed by millions of these devotees when he was taken over the, you know, through the this parade. Now, the Malayappa's biography, little bit maybe. What time we have? Okay, all right. So primarily, what I am going to talk about is during the Brahmotsava. It's a very important festival that is conducted on Tirumala town, on the seventh hill, and for almost 9 days. So during these 9 days, this Malayappa is presented in different forms, like a Krishna one day, like a Vishnu one day, like a Krishna killing the Kaliya serpent one day, and even feminine, he also appears in goddess forms, like a Saraswati, goddess of education, and the Mohini, you know. I will talk about those are the two important things. So, but here I will see, and his connection here, we are looking at his connection with the vehicle mounts. He rides on different vehicle mounts. There are a variety of vehicle mounts are produced. You can see the procession of Malayappa Swami. There is a Shesha Vahana. Vahana means vehicle. And Shesha means the seven-hooded serpent. So he is carried over that like a palanquin. And also he rides his favorite ride is Garuda. Is because Garuda is his first devotee. And like that. So there are different vahanas. So on each day, he is presented in a different form, and he also rides a different vehicle mount. And every his connection, his relationship with the Garuda is something different from his relationship with Shesha is different. So that is what here, you know, let me see that rather than going into description is important, but right now for us. After, you know, having said that, what relations that we can draw between Malayappa and his vehicle mounts? Question. Malayappa's relationship with Shesha mount is that of inseparable bond between Vishnu and the Adishesha serpent in Hindu mythology. In visual representations, Vishnu is never seen without serpent. Adishesha, the first serpent, represents the residue of the lost creation, which remains as part of the Vishnu, Vishnu because Vishnu is the creator, and who is always portrayed reclining on the coiled bed of the serpent in the midst of cosmic waters. So the Mount Sesha in Tirumala is described as the manifestation of Adishesha, so himself. And there is a mythology, there is a symbolism, all the seven hills are compared in the, you know, one of the Purana, and as the, you know, Adishesha, reclining Adishesha, like, you know. This is a natural phenomenon, again, here, you know. But anyway, now the Sesha's relationship, however, extends beyond the mythological symbolism. On the processional day, Sesha, day of Sesha, Malayappa, accompanied by his all that description, but Malayappa comes to the people. Okay, what is the message that they are doing? Here the TTD. The TTD plays a role. They have a Saptagiri Vani. They have a spiritual magazine. I will come back again. Okay, this is the one, the front cover of the Saptagiri, their magazine, spiritual magazine name. So they released a special magazine during this Brahmochava rituals, and they emphasized a lot with these relationships, what the relationships convey, the what messages they convey, and so it is here the TTD plays a great role. I will go back to a little bit and then come on. So here in the magazine, it comes, this statement comes from the magazine, it says so here, Malayappa coming on the Sesha serpent, you know, he is, who is described the Lord of Sesha, and he gives this message. What is the message? This is the, Malayappa reminds people of this master-servant relationship, how Adishesha serves Vishnu, all the time. That is the word emphasizing. This kind of servant devotion releases one from the ignorance of bestial nature into a space where one is blessed with humanity and reaches the higher realms of Vishnu. So this is the message they convey, through the Malayappa and his relation with the Sesha on that day. And here the details of the, you can see the Garuda image, and Garuda is also favorite. On that day, many people visit. I was really surprised because Garuda Vahana is very important. Garuda is the first devotee, selfless love, for his selfless love to the God, and that is again bhakti devotion. You know, that ideas are emphasized, bhakti devotion to Vishnu, seeking refuge solely in him. That is Sharanagati, very important concept in Vaishnava tradition. Solely refuge in taking. So this is what the Garuda Vahana conveys, that image, so that is, we are moving further, and I think we are doing good, knowing that time, 5 more minutes I will. I will talk before just one, two things important. He takes the gender even transformation. He is a male, until now, he is also dressed up, temporarily, like a goddess of Saraswati, Malayappa dresses up like a goddess Saraswati, as he is presented wearing a beautiful white sari and a prominent nose ring, etc., all that. And Swan, he rides on that day, Swan is the vehicle mount of Brahma. And here the importance is, the insight is, the Swan is a symbol of purity and perfected wisdom, knowledge. And the perfected wisdom can be attained through the process of learning or the path of knowledge, Jnana Marga, which is symbolized further through the Veena. He carries holds the Veena, the Saraswati, South Indian musical instrument. So, in his Saraswati form, Malayappa is said to have given this message. Again, TTD is reinforcing this message. God's grace is completely available to those who have obtained higher levels of intellectuality and those who know their own self through that knowledge. So, quote, close. So, this is the way kind of how TTD's role. And he takes also again Mohini. Mohini, in the mythology, he takes the Mohini form, a female form, a beautiful maiden, to actually to delude the demons from getting the Amrita, the nectar of immortality. Because he want to get the gods should get the Amrita, the nectar of immortality. So he deludes the demons, run after this beautiful maiden. You know, this is where the Vishnu Maya, Vaishnava Maya, he swayed by the Maya or delusion. So the Mohini comes when here, not this one, but we don't have images there. But the message that Malayappa conveys in his Mohini transformation is that the whole world is under the influence of illusion or perhaps eroticism sometimes, and whoever receives his grace in Mohini form during the Brahmotsava festival to overcome the world illusion. It is a message but reminding us the illusion, ignorance, the world is caught up, and then again he also says through the Saraswati form that one can get out of the ignorance and achieve the jnana, self. Okay, now we are done with the vehicle mounts and the relations. So now we are, this is the kind of final two or three slides here. This is the chariot procession, during the chariot procession on one of those great days. Why Malayappa becomes a spiritual agency? I use the words of other scholars. I will talk about that in the Vaishnava context. And also the pulling of Ratha chariot, the hundreds of people pull this chariot, some even die, and they don't care dying on that day. You know, they think that is auspicious and punya, merit. So, bodily experience. So, how these people who are in proximity to the God feel the bodily experience, that is what is a felt agency. Those two terms actually, it's a side note, used by I'm using his words, John Mitchell, he wrote a chapter called Performance Material Culture, Handbook of Material Culture. He talks about, his study is based on the Ireland and Catholic saint, and there is, in Ireland there are so many parishes, they conduct these processions of Saint Paul, and it's called Festa. And so he talks about how this statue of Saint Paul is carried by these selected members, and how the Saint Paul, the statue at one time becomes the image of saint, and saint is as transformed as works or functions as a spiritual agency, but protecting or giving blessings to the parishes and so he talks about that. And he talks about the people who carry the St. Paul's statue, who also feel this or a bodily experience because of their proximity to the St. Paul statue. That is called felt agency. So the people who participate in the Ratha Yatra, chariot procession, they are referred to, as I'm using the term, felt agency, because they are very emotional. They shout this, chant these names of the God while pulling that. It's a very heavy chariot that, So that is the body. And here Malayappa as a spiritual agency, just I will read a couple of statements here. Okay, Malayappa plays the role of a mediating agent through socially staged performative events and promotes cultural and spiritual values. That is the values that, moreover, Malayappa also becomes a spiritual agency and ensures the millions of participating devotees of his devotion and his blessings. As a spiritual agency, Malayappa promotes through Vahana mounts the values of bhakti, devotion, the path of knowledge, the master-servant relationship, and the aim of reaching the higher realms of Venkateshwara, that is Vishnu realm. So that is the spiritual agency. So not only they transform into, in this whole process, not only having relationships, special relationships, but they also, images also undergo some kind of transformation, and through that process they function as spiritual agent perhaps, and they also contribute to this participants that through this felt experience or bodily experience. Now the last statement, the impact of felt agents is undeniably powerful in Tirumala, which is clearly proven by from the record of more than 50,000 pilgrim devotees who come for the darshan of Venkateshwara and the festival processions, of course. And so on that day, what I am saying is Tirumala simply breathes the air of emotional fervor when thousands of devotees pull the Ratha chariot of Malayappa and his consorts. And so this is the one thing. And also I will conclude with, I have only 10 minutes. I think I will go with the questions maybe, you know. And that then through the questions we can more generate some discussion. Just on the Brahmacharya, on a normal day, the felt this experience, devoted devotion, I put two pictures. This is the one how TTD plays in different roles, when the selection and production, legitimization of material objects, and also creating these relationships, and through the using this spiritual magazine and enforcing all these ideas, Vaishnava traditions and teachings, etc., and also by thus by contributing to this mass devotional culture. I mean, why 50 million people are coming to the temple? Economic prosperity, I don't even talk about it. The whole lecture will take economic prosperity of the temple, how different things they do. So that is the embodied perception of Hindu temple religion, Vaishnava tradition, how it acts out as an agency. Agency is, in this sense, used as a collective, cumulative process of tradition, and how the tradition uses and sees this whole create a production of images. And they do not see any difference between the materiality and perception. Because in the Vaishnava tradition, God exists in both in the transcendental form and the immanent form, and that to have that immanent form, this is where that they have this connection through the avatars, incarnations, and also image incarnations. That is the reason why different types of images are created for different purposes, and both the function and the form and the function. And so and that is the perceptive world of Vaishnava tradition. They see one way here is completely engaged with the world and worshipping the God in different ways and through the different image forms. I will end with the I brought the quote. I mean, I want to say that quote, but I don't have much time. But this is a French philosopher of phenomenology, Maurice Merleau-Ponty. That's what he says also. I read the quote, his quote: truth does not inhabit only the inner man, or more accurately, there is no inner man. Man is in the world, and only in the world does he know himself. When I return to myself from an excursion into the realm of dogmatic common sense of science, I find not a source of intrinsic truth, but a subject destined to the world. He's talking about the man, how the embodied human being as a functioning locus with his own experiences, with the way his relationships with the world, the way he sees the world in different forms, and his relationship to the world. And so for him, he says that there is no inner man. But again, Hinduism, Vaishnavism, like so far whatever I talked, accepts that, because that is the world there. The perception of the Vaishnava perception is, embodied perception in the temple religion is to engage with the materiality of sacred images and that is the only way, the images serve as the agents or intermediary agents between the transcendental God and the immanent nature. So for the between the people and the transcendental God, the images serve as. But on the other hand, Hinduism also contradicts with what Monte is saying here. Ponte is saying that there is an inner man. After all, on the other spectrum of Hinduism, Upanishadic and Vedanta form, there is an inner man. And that is what that path says, that search for that inner man within yourself, and search for self within yourself, and find self in your within yourself. So, both ways. Hinduism is, that is, ways, a religion and philosophy of contradictions. That is the beauty of Hinduism. That's, so finally ends that. We have 5 minutes for questions.